Hi, this is Bob Scully, and welcome to another edition of The World Show, the Free Markets series. Our topic this week, national security. Much in the news, much discussed, but this time we're going to look at it from a free market and privatization perspective in the company of one of America's greatest specialists on the issue, David Insera from the Davis Institute for National Security. Here he is. David Insera, I'm reading one of your excellent research papers on security and defense in America, and you start with the history of all that, and you go into it in great detail, and it's very thorough, and then later you'll go to the future and tell us what might be happening or what we should be doing. But in the middle is a little sentence that I found very telling. It says, 9/11 changed all of that. That's the demarcation between the past and the future. And it's true that 9/11 changed all of that. We've been swimming upstream since then, trying to make things secure, but we're not quite there. Some people would say we're not there at all. So have we been successful?
I think this is a question that a lot of Americans are wondering. Every time there's something that, bad that happens, Department of Homeland Security has been created, we have all these new programs. Are we safe yet? Yeah. And I think this is the challenge that security professionals face, that they're always looking for ways that they can improve security, but there's always sort of the unattainable goal, right? We are never going to get to 100% security. And so when we, and here at this think tank that I work at, the Heritage Foundation, we're thinking about how can we provide the best security, but we're also looking at ways that we can do so in a cost-effective way based on risk. Where are the biggest risks? Where are the biggest threats we're facing? How do we counter those threats? We can't spend our money everywhere. We have a limited and finite amount of money.
Yeah, of course.
So how do we focus this finite money on these biggest risks? How do we reduce those threats? And how do we do so in a cost-effective way? And that's really what a lot of the research from that report you're talking about is really focused on doing. How can we be more effective in making us safe at home and do so maybe even with less money than we're spending right now?
And there seems to be a new factor that has entered the picture, which is really frightening, and it's a feeling of powerlessness. In the old days, whether it was the G-men against John Dillinger, or the cavalry out in the Wild West, or the posses that the sheriffs would send out, law enforcement would just add, as needed, more force and more determination, and finally they'd catch the culprit and be done with it. But the situation now is very different. A psychotic lunatic can get up to the top floor of a hotel, and if he's careful not to leave any trace, he will murder dozens of people and be successful. Terrorists, if they're good at it, will be able to sneak the bomb onto the plane. And all that leads to an awful feeling of powerlessness.
And this is a classic sort of asymmetric problem, right? Like, it's not something that we can simply say, if we put enough money against it, we can zero it out. This isn't like a one-to-one in a battlefield. This is, they're purposely avoiding our strengths, these actors, and they're going for the areas that we're not guarding. And unfortunately, every time we feel like we've tightened up one area, we've strengthened that area, there's always another area which we can't protect against. And that comes down to, like I said, the question of resources, and also a question of what we're willing to do as a society to make ourselves fully safe.
Yeah.
There are some things that we don't want to do because we recognize that those would infringe on our liberties. And so there's always these restrictions, both money and what we don't want to give up because we value our liberties. And so those are always, I think, in tension. But our objective here is to see how can we advance both security and fiscal responsibility and liberty. We try to not view it as much of a trade-off, but see how can we advance all of these things together.
And in your article, you also point out that there's a considerable amount of money being wasted, either because people are not directed in the right areas, or there's too many of them, or there's bureaucracy, too many rules, and so on. And you say we have to redirect that. But I found myself thinking, well, to redirect, we're going to need much better technology. I remember speaking to entrepreneurs in the field of spectrometry, and we weren't discussing security necessarily. They were telling us how good they've gotten at it, and they said, we can tell you what molecule is in that piece of wood in your chair. We can tell you what the fiber in the carpet, exactly what it is. We can break down any chemical structure and tell you what it is. And I said, well, why don't you use that in airport scanners and have something that really works? And they said, well, it's just too expensive. So we do have the technology and the knowledge. We don't have the cash.
Yeah, actually, right now it's a great example because literally they are working on starting to push that technology out to airports now. They're finally developing the ways that they think they've gotten it cheap enough to start to send those out to airports, that we can send out better X-ray machines, things that can better get into what exactly is in that bag, not just like a screenshot of a two-dimensional X-ray machine, but can we get some better technology to look at what's going through the baggage belt? These things are coming along, but certainly this is technology is a huge piece of this, and we do need to be looking at ways of how can we incentivize this technology to come forward more? How can we better use the know-how of the private sector? Because really, they're the ones who are going to come up with this. It's not going to be the government. We have to better utilize the private sector on this front.
I've noticed as well that some of the very efficient and yet less expensive technology, like retina scans, the eye, that has gotten more and more frequent. They're using it more and more.
And sometimes that's even on the airline side. So it might not even be the government doing that. Sometimes it's the airlines playing around with that because they think it provides a better service. Mm-hmm. If you show up and you check in with your iris,
your eyeball.
It's like, all right, well, and now here's off to the lounge, sir, and your ticket. And so some of the airlines are actually doing this because they think it's also just a better product. It's, security may be there as well, but they actually think it's just a better product. It's unique to see how the same sort of technology can be useful both on a security side, maybe a money side, and also just a customer service side as well.
One blessing that would be most welcome, and maybe privatization could lead to that, and I don't know if privatization could do it, but it would be to have quicker service and quicker human traffic at the airport. People are waiting online endlessly. Kids are bawling. People are tired. It's just a horror show. And you sometimes wonder, does it have to be that way? There must be a better way.
Yeah, and this is there's always going to be the struggle with waiting in line. No one likes to wait in the line. But there are, I think, things that we can do that will better enhance the efficiency of the line and also improve the experience that you have in that line. Mm-hmm. Right now, the U.S. has a small sort of pilot. It's not a pilot program, but it emerged out of a pilot program called the Screening Partnership Program. It's basically a very small, privatized version of the TSA that we use right now. Mm-hmm. But people who use that program seem to have the better customer service outcomes.
Why?
It seems that it comes down to the efficiency and the better training and management of personnel. The private sector is better at managing labor issues, managing personnel, than the government is. I mean, literally, these private sector companies are in the business of doing it. If they do it poorly, they get fired. They don't make any money. The government doesn't have that same incentive to necessarily fix something when it goes wrong. This lack of accountability is, I think, what allows, whether it be long lines, whether it be failed red team tests, if the inspector general comes through and sneaks a bomb through the airport line, and the TSA's, there'll be an angry congressman yelling at them at a hearing, but what really changes? Where's the accountability? The private sector can be held accountable, which is why I think you can see that change in behavior and why you see the better customer service in the private lines.
While we're on the subject of pet peeves, here's something else I often hear when I'm standing in these endless lines at airports. I listen, and probably people watching us do the same. One complaint that's always coming up, and people are whining about it as they wait, is taking off your shoes. And if I'm not mistaken, that goes back to one guy, the fellow who tried to light his shoe coming in from Europe and fortunately was an incompetent. But from that day on, everybody had to take off their shoes, and they're still doing it. And you have to wonder, is that really necessary?
And it's the same thing with liquids.
Indeed.
And this is why you talk about technology. We're hoping that, for instance, that new technology that I just mentioned before, there's a hope that that technology will hopefully make, those old liquid requirements obsolete. Maybe you'll be allowed to bring larger liquids back on a plane again. You won't have to check them.
Yeah.
So we'll see if that changes, but I know we're looking to change that because it does seem like we've had this rule for so long. Haven't we figured out a way to better deal with the problem than just inconveniencing everyone? Hopefully we're getting there now.
One thing I have heard studied and talked about a lot by law enforcement itself is the terrible possibility that the water supply could be poisoned by terrorists in a major city with untold consequences. And therefore, you see that in NYPD and some of the research I've read, working very hard to fend that off and make sure it doesn't happen. Do we have a grip on that?
Yeah, so you know we've looked at, and part of my research is I look at all the different terror plots that we've seen against the United States homeland. So far, that has not been a common target. But the idea of critical infrastructure that can have these very severe consequences, this is always the worry, because these are what we might term, you know, low probability but high consequence events. How do you protect against these type of events? And I said the best way to do so is you have to A, work with the private sector. In most cases, the critical infrastructure owner, it's a private sector. It's usually not the government who owns it. And so it's a matter of cooperation. Law enforcement has to be talking with the owner of that infrastructure and working together. If it's purely just a regulatory, government knows best sort of option, almost inevitably there are some problems. So I think there are some better ways that we can do those types of critical infrastructure protection. And it's honestly the way we do things. It's in a cooperative venture. Yes, there are regulations and things of that nature, but the reality is it needs to be cooperative, because at the end of the day, the private sector is the one, like I said, who owns almost all of the critical infrastructure in the United States.
Now, considering what you want to do, what you're arguing for very eloquently in your article, which is basically the privatization of the TSA. You want to move it from the public to the private realm. As you know very well, government bureaucracies always resist that. They are always against their own disappearance, and they don't want to foster it in any way, shape, or form, whether it's the post office or the TSA. And therefore, this thing is going to require, this revolution that you're arguing for, it's going to require a lot of political energy.
It definitely will. I mean, especially, and you've got the added issue of there's a labor union involved there. And so all these issues require political will. And I recognize that back in 9/11, look, we needed to do something after 9/11. But it literally took us 2 months to decide to go with this federal option. That's all the time we had to make a decision. We had to do something quickly. I think everyone recognized that. But we made a decision in 2 months, and you know, hindsight, looking back in hindsight, is maybe there's a better model. And when we look around the world, almost all the airports in Europe, for example, use a private model, where the model where the airport provides security and the government regulates the airport or the contractor. In Canada, they have another similar model. So almost all of the, sort of the countries that we would look to as being, you know, sort of like us and, you know, modern sort of industrialized countries use a different model. We chose something in a snap decision that we had to make. But now, 17 years later, I think it's time for us to relook at it. But it does require the will to say, to maybe face down this entrenched bureaucracy and interests that are already there.
Now, hindsight's 20/20, of course, and it's easy to second guess President Bush 43 or all the people around him at the time who were trying to act decisively and reassure an entire population, really the entire planet. And so we have to be careful with that. But I've often wondered, was it really wise in the heat of all that panic to suddenly jumble together huge bureaucracies, which may have been excellent each in their own right, but had nothing to do with each other? The DEA, the CIA, the TSA, the FBI. I mean, all these agencies have years and years of tradition and wisdom, accumulated knowledge. All of a sudden, overnight, they're under one umbrella. Was that really a good idea?
Yeah. So the creation of the Department of Homeland Security is, you know, it's obviously a big event, sort of in the Homeland Security world. Obviously, was it the right option? I view it as an important step forward. Could you have done it a different way? I think you could have. But it also comes, at the end of the day, there's always sort of a, what's the cost now of undoing it? Some people I know would say, do away with it. Well, you're just rearranging the chairs a little bit, but at the end of the day, someone still has to do aviation security, someone still has to do border protection, someone still has to do the Coast Guard duties. So all those duties will still exist, but the question is just, how have we arranged the chairs? How have we, you know, drawn the wiring diagram? And so I think right now we should work with what we have. It's definitely a workable organization. And to his credit, for instance, actually when we talk about the TSA specifically, George Bush actually wanted a more private model when it was the Senate who voted unanimously for a federalized model. And so you don't win everything. We need to do something. But yeah, right now there's clearly improvements we can make on the model that we have.
Your research is excellent, but there's one conclusion that I want to question with you a little bit, because I follow you on the efficiency of the privatization, the need for it, the fact that we have to be headed that way, and that it will create efficiencies. It will save money and a lot of useless bureaucracy. Fine. But you go from there and you jump to the conclusion that we were suddenly freeing up money for other needs. I kind of suspect that even if we do this more efficient model of the TSA or border secure ICE or whatever, we're going to unveil and create and reveal more needs that have not been met and probably will meet them better, like not separating families at the border and stuff like that. But it won't be less expensive. It'll be more efficient and more productive. Not quite the same thing.
I think it should be both here, right? So the reality is, if we save $100 million, what can we use that $100 million for? Well, I do think there are other security-related things that we could use the money on that mm-hmm. would be better uses of the money, definitely. There's also other really serious issues facing the United States, our debt and our deficit. Mm-hmm. And so it's a question of, if there's a really pressing need for more security money in some areas, and I've tried to identify those areas, so certainly, maybe the Coast Guard, for example, needs more money, and maybe some of the money that we save from this should go toward the Coast Guard. But as a general sort of principle, we should always be looking to just move money away from its inefficient uses toward the more efficient uses. And I think that's sort of I think we can both agree that the debt and the deficit is an important use to try to decrease.
Yeah, absolutely.
But so are other security things. And so I think you could probably do both. Put some more money toward the Coast Guard, but also use some to reduce our deficit.
And are we doing enough to train law enforcement properly? Of course, they are properly trained and they're very competent. And they do great work and they've been doing so for a long time. But as these tasks evolve in the way we've been describing, they become intermingled and ever more complex. Training should follow suit. Have we been doing that? Have we been putting enough resources into that?
Well, I think we've certainly made an improvement from where we were back before 9/11. Actually, the FAA, which is basically they're dealing with will the plane safely take off? That's mm-hmm. that's sort of their expertise. They were the ones responsible for security at the lines in the airports. So clearly, they weren't focused on security and training of the security personnel. Today, we clearly have done more. But like I said, this comes back to the question of, are there other types of organizations that know how to do training better? Mm-hmm. This is where I come back to the fact that I know that the private sector has a larger incentive to train their folks well, A, because there's no sort of public sector bargaining agreement. It's not a labor versus the public sector problem. But also just because the private sector has the incentive to make money. They want to have their personnel well-trained. I've had an opportunity to go to some airports where this is the case, and to see the exacting nature with which these folks take their job. When the private sector security is in place, they take the training and the if there's a problem, how they fix the problem with an employee, mm-hmm. they take that very seriously because they know they're accountable. And I think that's why we need to move to a more private-based model, because we get that greater accountability. And I think that bleeds over into cost savings and security savings and via better training and managing of personnel.
Looking back now at an entirely different era and area of security, when the roads, the interstate system was built in the U.S. linking the different states, J. Edgar Hoover appeared on the scene with the G-Men and so on at that point. And convince the government to have a national police force, and by telling them we couldn't chase the John Dillingers and the Bonnie and Clydes and the Pretty Boy Floyds and so on before, because they would go from state to state and we'd lose jurisdiction. With these new roads, we can. And so there's a forgotten example, but very true, of infrastructure helping law enforcement, helping different goals. Might we see that happening to terrorism, or is it too naive or idealistic to think one day we will eradicate most of it and we'll look back the way we look back today at Pretty Boy Floyd or John Dillinger as just pieces of history? Is that possible?
Well, I think we should recognize that terrorism, I think in one shape or form, will always exist. There's always going to be people who look at the world, they see something they don't like in it, and they decide that violence against civilians and innocent people is the best way to achieve their political outcome. Mm-hmm. What type of terrorist organization? What is their political objective? Why are they doing it? That will change. We've seen this change. Back in the 80s and 70s, you had communist terrorist groups. You have the IRA You have this cyclical change, and obviously now we have largely Islamist terrorists. So yes, I think you'll see a change in over time, but I think the reality is that for better or for worse, in this modern world we live in, there's a lot of great, awesome things that are going on in the world, great benefits that we can take advantage of, but there's a lot of people who want to turn those benefits against us, and they view those as weaknesses, and they want to attack us at those weak points. So no matter what terrorist organization we're talking about, I think we're always going to have to worry about how are we preventing these types of terrorists, no matter where they come from attacking our way of life.
From where you're sitting, because you have access to all this knowledge and all this research about terrorism and violence and so on, I'm curious about one thing. This is something that you hear now and then, that the most dangerous of all, we've been talking about groups, the most dangerous is always the single terrorist. And one tragic example that we saw recently is, of course, the Mr. Paddock, the fellow in Las Vegas, who was very successful at not revealing a thing ahead of time and not communicating or plotting or doing anything that would give him away. And he succeeded in his terrible act. Aren't they the most, the single terrorist, isn't that the most dangerous creature of all?
Yeah, right now, some people would call them lone wolf attackers. Mm-hmm. There's some problems and there's some good things and some bad things, and thinking about sort of the risk. Well, the one of the advantages is that one person by themselves usually can't plot a very elaborate plot. So they can't usually, have multiple airplanes, they can't hijack multiple airplanes. So there's a limit on what they can do in the complexity of the plot. But sometimes the simplicity, just knives or just a weapon or just like one handgun in a well-placed location, can still cause a lot of harm. And because it's just one person, as you pointed out, you didn't tell anyone. Sometimes those kind of attackers, it's hard to detect them. A lot of our counterterrorism framework right now is based on intelligence. How do we detect someone before they attack? That's the best way to do it.
It really requires a conspiracy to break into that ahead of time, and to know that somebody has to be conspiring with somebody. You can't have a conspiracy of one.
It's a conspiracy of one, then how do you break into that? It becomes much harder.
The counterterrorism specialists, the people within law enforcement who struggle with this and who work very, very hard to prevent it, when something like this happens and a terrorist is able to outwit the system, outwit the safeguards, bypass everything and do his deed, do they get discouraged?
Well, I think there's always, when something bad happens, law enforcement, counterterrorism, intelligence officials are always going to, there's always going to be an investigation. First of all, did we miss anything? I think there's always some of that. But at the end of the day, I do think that there's a good amount of room for, pride in the fact that we have, at least to date, stopped a lot of significant plots. I talked about the water bottle, the liquids in planes, for example. That was a plot that was stopped that was supposed to take down multiple airplanes on the way to the United States. So we've been able to foil some of these bigger, complex plots because of our better intelligence. But even these other smaller incidents can still cause a lot of harm to various communities. And so clearly, more can be done. But we should also recognize that these things aren't going to be going away. And so we have to be prepared to fight this, we might call it the long war. You have to be prepared for this for a while. And we can't just sort of give up and say, I don't think anyone's going to attack me anymore. They are. They're looking for the best way, the softest target to do so.
One unexpected silver lining, I don't know if you noticed this, but I find that in the past 2 years, for terrible reasons, because there's been more of this, the local police and the police chiefs, the elected officials, all the community, the law enforcement community in a wider sense, reacts better, more professionally at reassuring people, at getting the information out through the media, at knowing what to say and what not to say, and of course tracking down the culprits, which they always did or tried to do. But there's a kind of competence that has grown in the past 2 years, again, for terrible reasons, but at least we're better at confronting that and then dealing with it.
I think so, and I think we're just dramatically better than we were, like I said, before 9/11. Can we do more? Should we do more? Can we improve? Of course, and I think that's what we're hoping to do in this town here in Washington, D.C. We're hoping to make a difference in the way congressmen and policymakers approach these important security issues.
Well, David and Sarah, thank you. It's been a wonderful discussion on a very tough topic. But somebody's got to do it, and you're doing it. and getting to the bottom of all these things. So more power to you and long life and good luck.
Thank you very much.